WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It may be hard today to imagine that Americans' hope of ending one of the world's greatest conflicts was a pianist. But that's what many felt after the 23-year-old Texan virtuoso Van Cliburn won the 1958 Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. His performance of the Russian composer's first piano concerto earned him not just the top prize, but also a bear hug from Nikita Khrushchev. It was a performance some thought was so perfect, it might end the Cold War. The episode is written about in a new book that highlights the intersection of classical music and politics in 20th century conflicts from two world wars through the Cold War. In his book, Dangerous Melodies, Classical Music from the Great War through the Cold War, Hunter College and the Graduate Center at City University professor Jonathan Rosenberg writes, quote, "What happened in the concert hall and opera house was inseparable from the destiny of the United States and the well-being of the American people." Professor Rosenberg joins me in studio. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Great to be here.
You write in your book that over the decades, Americans did, quote, thinking through music.
Yes.
How so, and how does that apply to the research you did for this book?
Sure. It's a sweeping study from World War I through the Cold War. And during those many decades, the American people thought about things like democracy, freedom, tyranny, oppression, patriotism, what it meant to be an American, and they used classical music, by which I mean the sort of work of composers, instrumentalists, singers, conductors. They used the world of classical music to try to understand the wider world.
And when you think, when you say patriotism, what do you mean?
Well, for example, during World War I, there was a tremendous degree of anti-German sentiment in the United States, an enormous xenophobia. And German musicians in the United States, German musicians, German-American mm-hmm. musicians, were victimized by that. Their music, a lot of German music was banned in the United States. It was mm-hmm. proscribed.
The Metropolitan Opera did.
The Metropolitan Opera stopped playing all German opera in the 1917-18 season and after that. German musicians lost their jobs in the United States, large numbers of them. Some were put in prison, in prison camps. Mm-hmm. So this was... If you were a patriot, you weren't supposed to be listening to German music. You weren't supposed to be playing German music. You weren't even supposed to be interested in German music. The American people, I think, used the story of music in America to think about things like patriotism and what it meant to be a loyal American.
But as you mentioned in your book, the German presence in the United States was what you describe as considerable. So how are these German Americans affected by this?
Well, this is I think it's a story that a lot of people are unfamiliar with, but from the late 19th century into the early 20th century, this was a very xenophobic period in American mm-hmm. history, which there have been many xenophobic periods in American history, as I think many of us know. When we get to the First World War, and particularly American intervention into the war in 1917, that xenophobia, which had sort of been pervasive across American society, was really directed at Germans in the United States in all sorts of very unpleasant ways. It wasn't merely classical music. Mm-hmm. German language books were taken from library shelves. The German language instruction was banned in schools. There was a lynching of a German man in a small Illinois town. All of this spilled over into the world of classical music. German musicians and German music was not immune from the xenophobia that was washing over the country.
My guest is Jonathan Rosenberg. The name of his book is Dangerous Melodies, Classical Music in America from the Great War through the Cold War. You write about Wagner.
Yes.
Still, as we say today, problematic.
Yes, absolutely.
Still problematic today. But within the period of time you're writing, mm-hmm. tell us about how people felt about Wagner.
This too, of course, I'm biased, I think is very interesting. Wagner was very popular in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, and even up through the beginning of the First World War until the United States entered the war. The war began in 1914, U.S. entered in 1917. At that point, there was a kind of cry throughout the United States to ban the performance of Wagner. People simply didn't want to hear his music. Now, there were some who did. Their voices eventually were drowned out by those who didn't. And Wagner operas were banned in the United States. If there were orchestral pieces that were by Wagner, which were not full operas, those pieces were still acceptable. But what people really didn't want to hear was the German language. It made people very uncomfortable, made them angry. It infuriated them. It frankly terrorized them in a sense. Now, interestingly enough, this is during the First World War. Interestingly enough, because you said, you know, over the wider span of things, mm-hmm. this didn't happen in World War II. In World War II, Americans were quite happy to continue to sort of go back to their love of Wagner, and they continued to listen to Wagner throughout the war, with the exception of one piece, Die Meistersinger, which was not performed. But Wagner was embraced during World War II, unlike during World War I, when it was just ferociously banned.
Something I thought about as I was reading one of your descriptions of Wagner was mm-hmm. that it was also the sound of it. Did you say it was like a bullhorn or like a blast?
Yes.
That it was actually the sonic element of Wagner that got to people on a real visceral level?
Well, certainly Wagner is very distinctive. The sound of Wagner's music is altogether distinctive. The thing that really bothered people during World War I, though, I think, was hearing the German language. And there are all sorts of in the book I talk about this extensively, where people, when they would hear people singing Wagner on the stage, it reminded them of what was going on the battlefield. And as I think I say in the book, if I'm quoting myself accurately, the opera house became a battlefield. The concert hall became a battlefield. And all sorts of competitions and contestations unfolded in those settings which of course had not ever experienced that sort of thing before. But people were very, very viscerally affected by hearing the German language sung from the stages, say, of the Metropolitan Opera House or other places in the country. Thus, it was banned.
Some of the towering figures in classical music, though, they were able to make political statements in their choices. And I'm thinking of the case of Toscanini.
Absolutely.
How did he confront fascist influence?
Toscanini is, I suppose, he is a rather heroic figure in the book. Toscanini was, in his way, he was a highly political man, although he claimed that politics and music should be kept apart. What he really wanted to make sure of was that music was not used to advance anti-democratic political aims. And he was a ferocious anti-fascist. Of course, Toscanini was Italian. Mm-hmm. He was quite a central figure in American musical life. And he, for example, he was very outspoken against Mussolini when he was in this country, and also quite courageous when he was conducting in Italy. He refused, and I describe this in the book in detail, you know, he would refuse to play the fascist hymn, the Italian fascist hymn when he was there, and it got him into hot water. In fact, it was physically dangerous for him to continue conducting there. When he came back to the United States and was conducting, he was a conductor of the New York Philharmonic, mm-hmm. he was very outspoken, again, with respect to Mussolini, but then with respect to Hitler. And he was probably, in fact, not probably, I would say he was the most important classical music spokesperson with respect to what was going on in Europe, first in Italy and then in Germany. He lent his name to a group of musicians who reached out to Hitler, who sent a cable to Hitler in 1933 saying, look, what you're doing to artists in Germany is unacceptable, and we call on you to stop. This was a very important moment, and it was something that people in the United States, it was widely covered in the press, mm-hmm. people in the United States were very, very animated by. And he came to be seen throughout his life, you know, through the 30s and on through World War II, as really perhaps the leading spokesman against anti-democratic regimes across the world. And in this case, we're really speaking particularly about fascism in Europe. So he's really quite, I would say, in that respect, music aside, he's obviously an enormously significant figure musically, but as a kind of a beacon of speaking out for freedom, he was very, very, in my estimation, quite laudable.
Why was that considered brave at the time?
Well, for one thing, some of the things he actually did on the ground when he was in Europe, he was in danger. I mean, he was beaten up outside an opera house in Italy in, I guess it was 1931. So in that sense, he was bold. Now, when he is speaking up against these things in the United States, obviously when he's here, it's not so much that he's courageous, but what he was completely willing to do and determined to do was lend his name, because he believed that his name could help to advance the cause of democracy around the world, and he was quite determined to do this and in a very consistent way over time. And in that sense, I think he was the, as I said, the single most important classical musician in this era in this kind of political context.
My guest is Jonathan Rosenberg. The name of his book is Dangerous Melodies, Classical Music in America, From the Great War to the Cold War. And you write that during the Cold War, quote, U.S. policymakers sought to win the East-West struggle. They refashioned violins and trumpets, transforming them into yet another type of Cold War weaponry. To be sure, these diplomatic instruments toppled no buildings and caused no bloodshed. But there was something unsavory about a policy that marshaled the country's most esteemed musical institutions and deployed them overseas to participate in a fearsome and destructive conflict. Would you explain this?
Sure. During the Cold War, the United States government sent symphony orchestras around the world. They did this in order to spread the message, I suppose, of liberal capitalism, to show the world that the United States was not merely a place which could make Hollywood blockbusters or large automobiles, but in fact we could sort of involve ourselves in high culture. We could in effect produce symphony orchestras that could play the grandest mm-hmm. music in the world, and we would expose the world's people to those sorts of things. Show the world's people that the American people had a soul. In doing that, they sent orchestras, many of the great orchestras in the United States, the Boston Symphony, the New York Philharmonic, the Philadelphia Orchestra, Cleveland, they sent them all over the world to propagate that message. Now, I will also say that they were trying to advance the diplomatic interests of the United States. The musicians in the orchestra, and I spend a lot of time in the book talking mm-hmm. about Leonard Bernstein, they had a rather different objective. Their objective was to use symphony orchestras and symphonic music to create cooperation, global, basically international harmony through music, if you will. So someone like Leonard Bernstein was not trying to achieve a political objective for the United States. He was trying to make the world a more peaceful and cooperative place. The quote that you read, which kind of reflects my view on this, I do think there is something rather unsavory about the U.S. government using these glorious institutions, symphony orchestras,
as propaganda.
Yes, as tools, as instruments, if you will, of propaganda. That has always left me rather cold in the Cold War.
We've got about a minute left, and I do want to note that one of the chapters is called The Baton is Mightier Than the Sword. It's
yes.
something someone said. But you write that may not be true.
Yes. It pains me to have to report this, and others might disagree. I'm sure they have and will continue to do so. There was a sense that you know, by sending orchestras around the world, the baton held by the conductor, that could somehow help pacify the world, help make the world a more peaceful, secure, a humane place. When we look at the history of the Cold War, despite the fact that these grand institutions were sent all over the world, in the end, I think the baton was not mightier than the sword, although, as I said, it pains me to have to acknowledge that.
The name of the book is Dangerous Melodies, Classical Music in America, From the Great War Through the Cold War. Its author is Jonathan Rosenberg, Professor of U.S. History at Hunter College. Professor, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to speak with you.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. I will meet you at the top of the hour.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.